North Korea is accused of selling weapons to Russia. Meanwhile, the arms business is good in another country.
Russia, before the Ukraine war, was the biggest exporter, or the second biggest exporter in arms in the world. And their market is collapsing because their armaments are not functioning well.
Plus, it's almost Christmas in Kyiv.
Well, I should say that this year is a special year in terms of Christmas for Ukraine, because this is the first year when Ukrainian church officially announced that church celebration would actually take place also on the 24th and 25th.
And later in the program, we take a look at the destruction of cultural sites across Ukraine. Today is Friday, December 23rd. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. After a whirlwind few days and a historic trip to Washington, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is back in Kyiv. In a video address Friday morning, Zelensky said he's returned to his office to continue working on victory, as his address was interrupted by a ringing telephone.
Good morning to all. I wish you all good health. You hear telephones are already working here. I'm at the office. We're working towards victory. Good day to all. We'll overcome everything.
That's President Zelensky back in Kyiv. The U.S. is accusing North Korea of selling weapons to the Wagner Group, a private Russian military contractor, to be used in Ukraine. Sagar Magani has the details.
The White House says a private Russian military company is getting help from another rogue state to boost the fight in Ukraine. Mercenaries from the Wagner Group have been fighting in Ukraine alongside Russian troops, and National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says as Moscow's military falters,
President Putin has increasingly been turning to Wagner,
which is now turning to North Korea.
Last month, North Korea delivered infantry rockets and missiles into Russia for use by Wagner.
Kirby says the U.S. does not assess the materiel from North Korea will change the war's dynamics, but is concerned more weapons are coming. The Biden administration notes the North is banned from importing or exporting weapons per sanctions imposed by the U.N. Security Council, of which Russia is a member. Sagar Magani, Washington.
For its part, North Korea's foreign ministry has denied media reports that it supplied munitions to Russia, and it's denounced the United States for providing lethal weapons to Ukraine. On Friday, North Korea's official state news agency, KCNA, quoted a foreign ministry spokesperson calling the accusation groundless. Ryan Brooks reports.
On Friday, North Korea's foreign ministry denied a media report that Pyongyang had supplied munitions to Russia. That was first reported in Japan's Tokyo Shimbun newspaper. The paper had said that North Korea had shipped munitions to Russia via train through their shared border last month, including artillery shells, and that more were expected in the weeks to come. The White House said on Thursday a private Russian military company, the Wagner Group, took delivery of an arms shipment from North Korea to help bolster Russian forces in Ukraine. The UK also said it had come to the same conclusion and condemned the move, but Wagner's head, Yevgeny Prigozhin, dismissed the talk as gossip and speculation. And North Korea's foreign ministry spokesman said the report was groundless, that, quote, the Japanese media's false report that our country offered munitions to Russia is the most absurd red herring. The statement did not make any mention of Wagner. And the Russian mission to the United Nations in New York did not respond to a request for comment. The South's foreign ministry said they had been monitoring North Korea's activity amid concerns over possible armed transactions with Russia. The back and forth comes after a year in which North Korea has tested an unprecedented number of missiles, including an intercontinental ballistic missile designed to reach the U.S. mainland.
Ryan Brooks of Reuters reporting. And staying on the subject of weapons sales, the Israeli arms industry is growing fast, due in large part to Russia's war in Ukraine and increasing threats from Iran. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli arms exports were up 30% last year to $11.3 billion and are on track for even more in the next year. Israeli security analysts attribute much of the increased demand for weapons to the war in Ukraine. Yossi Melman writes on intelligence and security at Israel's Haaretz newspaper.
The Russian invasion to Ukraine was and still is a wake-up call for NATO. It's the first confrontation on European soil in which NATO finds itself almost in a war or near to a military conflict with Russia. That awareness has suddenly brought NATO to the realization that they need all sorts of weapons, not just from the United States, but also to increase the purchasing from Israel.
Analysts say that one of the attractions of Israeli weapon systems is that they are proven in actual battle conditions, in contrast to weapons from other exporters. Shlomo Shapiro is the director of the Europa Institute at Bar-Ilan University in Israel.
Russia, before the Ukraine war, was the biggest exporter or the second biggest exporter in arms in the world. And their market is collapsing because their armaments are not functioning well. Everyone can see it in the Ukraine. And so a lot of countries go to Israel to buy new systems because they are unhappy with the Russian systems that they have.
According to analysts, Israeli military technology is seen as an important tool against the growing threat of Iranian military power. The concern about Iran is shared by both European and Middle Eastern countries, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco, countries which signed the Abraham Accords peace deals with Israel 2 years ago. Again, Yossi Melman of Haaretz.
Iran, which has been a source of the instability, but only in the Middle East, is suddenly sending drones to Russia, and he's forming a military and security alliance with Russia to improve the Russian poor performance against Ukraine. So all these factors are coming together, and the war is helping Israel in that sense, is helping Israeli posture in the world and in Europe. And as a byproduct of it, Israel is increasing its share of the armament market.
The Israeli arms industry will get another boost from the recent deal between Rafael and the U.S. company Lockheed Martin to collaborate on the new Iron Beam anti-missile laser system. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
As we've heard, following recent Russian attacks on energy infrastructure, Ukraine's energy operator will start conducting emergency shutdowns in the Kyiv area. Last week, VOA Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gungadze visited key energy facilities that supply electricity across the country.
Russian bombing of Ukrainian energy infrastructure in recent months has left more than 10 million Ukrainians without electricity. Many had no heating or water as winter set in. This energy facility in central Ukraine has been hit multiple times in recent months. The CEO of Ukraine's energy operator Ukrenergo, Volodymyr Kudrytsky, showed VOA one of the substations that are critical to the Ukrainian power grid. The substation's transformer, essential for bringing energy to millions of Ukrainians, was destroyed during a recent attack.
Russians already launched more than 1,000 heavy missiles and kamikaze drones, specifically at Ukrainian electric grid, mostly Ukrenergo objects, like transmission objects, but also power plants. And this makes this campaign against power system the largest in human history. Nobody ever has experienced what we are experiencing now.
Kudrytsky says Ukrenergo must introduce rolling power cuts to maintain the balance between generation and consumption in the system, and this affects millions of Ukrainians. Russian and Ukrainian energy system used to be connected. Kudrytsky says Russian energy experts are advising the Russian military on what part of the system to attack to inflict the most suffering.
They also are picking up time when it's cold outside to disconnect from the grid water supply heating systems and therefore destroy this critical infrastructure, these types of critical infrastructure as well. Because electricity grid is the most basic type of critical infrastructure. Without it, nothing else works.
Most of Ukraine's electricity is generated by nuclear energy. Ukraine has 15 reactors at 4 nuclear power plants. A month ago, after a massive Russian attack, the Rivne nuclear power plant, located 60 kilometers from the Belarusian border, was forced to stop operation due to severe damage to the Ukraine energy system. The biggest power station in western Ukraine, Rivne, supplies more than 15,000 gigawatt hours of electricity per year to the national grid. The station's director says they work with the military to protect the facility. However, they need more assistance from the international community.
First, we need protection of the critical energy infrastructure.
The head engineer of the station adds,
because of the missile attack, we need to pay more attention to safety of our station. And the international community came to understand what the nuclear safety in Ukraine is the problem in the whole world, not the problem only the Ukraine.
Well, Ukrainian's President Volodymyr Zelensky argued U.S. President Joe Biden to assist in safeguarding the country's energy grid. He said the barrage of Russian missiles and drones had destroyed 50% of Ukraine's grid network. Ukraine's energy infrastructure remains the main target of Russian attack. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Ukraine.
Now it's time to check in with Anna Chernikova as Kyiv is preparing for Christmas.
Well, I should say that this year is a special year in terms of Christmas for Ukraine, because this is the first year when Ukrainian church officially announced that church celebration would actually take place also on the 24th and 25th, as the rest of the Europe is doing. So, because before, Ukrainians were celebrating in early January. So this year, a lot of Ukrainians will actually celebrate with the rest of Europe. So tomorrow and after tomorrow would be this Christmas weekend, and it's important that church also support it. So Ukraine is, you know, starting this transition. This year celebrations would take on the both date. So some people would celebrate tomorrow and after tomorrow, and some people in January. But still, this process has started, and actually a lot of Ukrainians wanted this. So I should say that Ukrainians are trying to create a Christmas mood. Of course, it's not as it is usually in Ukraine, because of course, due to war, no celebrations will be happening. There are Christmas trees around Ukraine, across the country, and in Kyiv as well. But these Christmas trees are very different from what we've seen in the past years. It's more like, you know, symbolic Christmas trees. So people are trying, you know, to create little Christmas mood at home and also around the city. You can see some restaurants, some stores, you know, putting some lights on and putting some decorations. But to be honest, you cannot really feel the celebration mood, because still, there is quite dark because of lack of electricity around. And I can say that it's really a very special Christmas. But everyone just, you know, pray that this Christmas season would bring Ukrainians closer to peace.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. Some of the casualties of war are hard to see. Things like history, language, and culture, it seems, are fair game. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports on the attempts at erasing history in the city of Mariupol.
Throughout the port city of Mariupol, Russian workers are tearing down bombed-out buildings, hauling away shattered bodies with the debris. As well as eradicating all evidence of war crimes within the buildings, Russia is getting rid of all vestiges of Ukraine and the city itself. Phone and television networks are now Russian. Mariupol is now in Moscow's time zone, and the Ukrainian currency is slowly dying out. The few schools that are open teach a Russian curriculum. Petro Andriushenko, Mariupol's deputy mayor, told the AP that parents are threatened if they hear their children speaking Ukrainian. They're rewriting history. They're rewriting a national identity. What can we say? Despite their efforts, Mariupol residents know all too well that the Russians are building on a city of death, with over 10,000 new graves scarring the war-torn city. I'm Karen Chamas.
As we've just heard, culture can often be a casualty of war, often deliberately. The New York Times has published an extensive article documenting 339 Ukrainian cultural sites that have been damaged in the war. Sarah Kerr is a video journalist with the New York Times. She's on the team that published the piece.
So this is an effort that actually started in March of this year. I was working covering breaking news in the early weeks of the war, and along with my colleagues Haley Willis and Inara Tiefenthaler, we began seeing a lot of reports of the destruction of cultural sites on social media and on local news sites. And over the months that passed, we amassed this list that ended up being, as you mentioned, 339 sites that have been significantly damaged or destroyed throughout Ukraine. You know, it's been a really interesting and really sad story to tell. I think increasingly as the list got longer and we learned more and more about these sites, we felt like it was important both to, you know, continue adding to our list and building a larger and larger data set, but also to think about ways to capture the human stories.
I mean, I hate to sound trite, but this is a war. Destruction is going to happen. Things are going to get broken. Do we know that these places were damaged deliberately? And if we do know, how do we know?
In terms of determining whether or not damage is deliberate, you know, it's really tricky. There's a lot going on. It's difficult to prove chain of command. We do have in our data set instances, especially when it comes to the destruction of statues and monuments, that are clearly pretty deliberate. You know, we have video footage of statues being removed or being hit with a sledgehammer, pushed over, etc. But in the majority of cases, you know, I think what we can say is that regardless of what happened, you know, the invasion itself, the war itself, shows a callous disregard for Ukrainian cultural sovereignty and for the political sovereignty of Ukraine.
You briefly mentioned in your piece, but we've heard from other reporters on the ground in Ukraine as well, that even in parts of Ukraine that were never occupied by Russia, Ukrainians are removing references to the Russian and to the Soviet past. You mentioned monuments to Pushkin, for example. Is that the same kind of thing?
So, you know, I am not an expert in Ukrainian history, et cetera. I think it's not my place to comment, actually.
Do you see any parallels between the videos of Russian soldiers knocking down Ukrainian monuments to the recent controversy here in the United States with Civil War monuments?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something that we talked about quite a lot in putting together this story. And I think, you know, it's difficult to compare cultural contexts. I do think they are different contexts. And so I don't want to say that they're equivalent, but, you know, they are both conversations about which people and ideas should be prominently displayed in our collective spaces.
Is this kind of targeted destruction of cultural sites, is it worse in this conflict than in others? I mean, this isn't the first time this has happened, is it?
No, it's not necessarily something that is unique to this conflict, but we felt like it was an important thing to focus on specifically in Ukraine at this moment because of Russian rhetoric, especially rhetoric coming from places like the Kremlin, that is very dismissive of the idea of Ukrainian culture, dismissive of Ukrainian language, dismissive of the idea that Ukraine's past is separate from that of Russia.
Your article highlights four specific sites, so I'd like to bring our listeners a description of those. One of them is a monastery in Donetsk. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the first site we focused on was the Sviatohorsk Monastery in Donetsk, which is a 16th century monastery that has been most recently controlled by the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchy branch. And it's a place that came under, has come under shelling or come under strikes a number of times since the beginning of the war.
You also talk about a place called the Workers' House of Science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so another section of our data set are community cultural centers. And specifically within that, we have a lot of houses of culture, which were, you know, Soviet community centers that existed during the USSR. They were run mainly by the Communist Party and were places where workers could come participate in leisure activities. And many of them were these really beautiful buildings that in some communities have continued to function since Ukraine became democratic. And so we focused on one in Lyman that was a very dynamic and lively cultural center before the war. And unfortunately now has basically been sort of reduced to rubble.
Your article also mentions a library.
Yes, and we thought this was particularly poignant because many of the libraries had Ukrainian, you know, books in Ukrainian, Ukrainian literature, volumes in their collections that were unique to the places that they, where they were based. So newspaper archives, things like that. And the library that we focused on is in Severodonetsk, and is a place that had become a community hub, especially since 2014, welcoming in internally displaced people from elsewhere in the Donbas.
And as you mentioned earlier, the video footage of the toppling of a monument, this one in Manhush?
Part of what we found in our reporting is that the destruction of statues and monuments is something that is being filmed and distributed in some ways for propaganda purposes, especially within Russian media and also on Ukrainian channels. We focused on a site in Manhush where a statue to a Cossack general was removed and then broadcast on Russian state TV.
Earlier in today's program, we heard from AP correspondent Karen Chamas, who is telling us about similar events going on in the port city of Mariupol. And in your article, you guys mention the theater in Mariupol. Can you tell us what happened there and why it's important?
So I would say that, sadly, at this point in the conflict, the Mariupol theater and what happened there is a thing that remains as a horror and an atrocity that will stick in people's minds for a long time. I think, you know, I have not personally reported on this, but what we do know is that there were people sheltering in the Mariupol theater and it was hit by Russian airstrikes. The tally of people who may have died remains slightly unclear. But regardless, it was a horrific, horrific incident. And that building within the city of Mariupol, very large, very prominent in sort of the main city center. And what we can have seen recently in satellite imagery is that the occupying Russian forces have put up large screens around the building itself, blocking it from public view. It's a little unclear what is being done there. But it's a place, you know, that where people were sheltering, where they thought they could find safety in a large building, in this case, a cultural building. And unfortunately, that was not the case.
Sarah Kerr, a video journalist with the New York Times. Ms. Kerr, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com. And on social media, follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.